All right. It's a pleasure to welcome David Yu to the Neuroscience Seminar Series. David, in a sense, comes to neuroscience through the back door because he started working on muscle and heart contraction. But I guess everybody in this room would agree with me that we can consider the heart an honorary neuron. And so it counts as neuroscience anyway. But his main interest is in calcium signaling and mechanisms of calcium channels, and that's really been a consistent interest throughout his career. We were just talking about, I think I first became aware of his work when I was a graduate student, and he was working on calcium moving through calcium channels and then modulating those calcium channels by and really that's still what he's working on. And now, though, he has worked out a lot of the really important features of that, and that has really transformed the way we think about calcium signaling. And it's been actually a very exciting year to be reading the papers coming out of his lab, because it's really been a huge step forward, and I'm very excited to hear about the work. David has been at Hopkins since before I can remember. He did his graduate work there. He's an MD-PhD and did the MD-PhD program at Hopkins, and has continued on the faculty in the bioengineering and neuroscience departments. And I'm just going to keep the introduction short so we can hear about calcium. Thank you, David.
My first professor, Kichi Sagawa, was a wonderful Japanese scientist who was a teenager during World War II, and he told us that he expected fully to die before the end of the war, but when he survived, he counted every day that he was alive as a gift, and he approached life and science that way. He told me that he really liked this ancient Japanese story about how a very wise Japanese monk was able to look at a single grain of rice and with a very fine paintbrush paint an entire haiku poem on top of this rice grain. And he said, "If I want to be able to look at my science and look at a single rice grain and see the universe in it." So I've been working on calcium channels for a while. I'm still looking for the universe in it. Hopefully I can show you a few rooms today. Okay, so we're going to start with the premise that calcium is very, very important ion, because it's not just a dumb charge carrier to shape electrical signals, but it's an important second messenger signaling molecule in its own right. And because of that status, I figured out early in my career that if you study the molecules that convey these calcium ions, that encode them and decode them, that you're going to find a lot of interesting features in that. And so that's sort of the philosophical premise of the work in my lab over the past years. In particular, I'm going to be talking about what we found about a ubiquitous calcium sensor, calmodulin, that sits very close to this pore of an open channel, and just some of the tricks that it's up to and what it could teach us, maybe not only for calcium channels, but in general for the encoding and decoding of calcium signals. Okay, here's a, to be a little bit more specific, a high-resolution view of calmodulin. It's a wonderful molecule, 17 kilodaltons, and it has a pseudosymmetry, two globular domains, or golf balls, if you will, and each of them has two calcium binding, EF-HAN calcium binding sites on them. And the basic idea is that in low calcium, such as in resting calcium, these sites are largely unoccupied, and calmodulin would be found in the cytoplasm self-interacting sort of by itself. But when calcium rises, these red dots, and plugs into it, it undergoes a conformational change and now becomes very social in search of molecules that it binds to if you have the right kind of binding site. This calmodulin will then bind to this molecule and change its state of being. If you're a kinase, for example, from inactive to active, very happy in this sort of situation. And in this way, you can convert a change in calcium fluctuation, calcium concentration, into a change in molecular function. Now, the sort of first-order ideas about how this worked had two features in this. The first is that the calcium-free form of calmodulin, which we call apocalmodulin, is cytoplasmic. It only binds to its target when it becomes calcified and social. And secondly, that the switching is somewhat all or none, although there's four calcium binding sites that you had to populate most or all of them in order to get this change in molecular function. Okay, now let's go to a higher resolution view of calmodulin in its embrace of a piece of the calcium channel. And this is a structure that Masayuki Mori, who finished up in my lab as a postdoc, solved in conjunction with Dan Leahy's lab in biophysics at Johns Hopkins. And here we see calcium calmodulin as it is interacting with a very important part of the calcium channel, of CAV2 channels, a so-called IQ domain. It's a very interesting kind of calcium cam and apocam binding motif. And in this setting, some of the first order rules are out the window. Number one, that apocalmodulin is not cytoplasmic. It's going to be found pre-associated with the channels, sort of as a resident calcium sensor. And secondly, that all or none on-off switching is not the case. And so for the rest of my talk, I'll be basically telling you how calmodulin is particularly smart in this setting and how it manages to be that smart. So I'd like to focus on three topics today, if I can. The first of these is a manner of review. I'm going to review sort of the evolution of the field from about 1999 to about 2003. And that's going to try to convince you that there's some very interesting calcium decoding properties of calmodulin in its regulation of the family of voltage-gated calcium channels. Secondly, and thirdly, I'm going to focus on how we believe that some of these smart features come about. This first body of work was pioneered by a former postdoc in my lab, Carla DeMaria, and what she found is that calmodulin actually has two forms of selectivity for calcium signals as it produces feedback regulation on the calcium channel family. And what I mean by local and global selectivities will become clear as we go through the next few slides. Okay, so this is a really nice example of the kind of regulatory power that calmodulin can exert on the family of voltage-gated calcium channels. This is an example of taken from PQ type or alpha-1A calcium channels, the dominant calcium entry pathway in the central nervous system. So these are responsible for neurotransmitter release in a lot of synapses. And short-term synaptic plasticity is very important for the computational repertoire of neuronal circuits. So here we're just looking at a pure population of these channels under really nice voltage clamp. But if you play kind of a train of physiological spikes at 100 hertz, you get this sort of calcium entry on the first spike with calcium going through these channels. So it's sort of like a mini tail current coming on the downslope of the action potential waveform. But in a train of these, what you see is something very interesting. They don't stay at the same level. It's not like we saw from SQUID in the very early days with George Augustine. It's different. After you give a few charges of activation, the currents are actually getting larger. It's as if it's facilitating become a better channel, kind of positive feedback, if you will. And that's over tens of milliseconds. And then if you go on for hundreds of milliseconds, it starts to decline away as if there's a kind of inactivation or a negative feedback. So there's a facilitation, apparently, and an inactivation. And you can start to convince yourself that it's a really calcium-driven phenomenon because if you run barium through the channel, that's something you can do biophysically, this waveform pattern is relatively flat. So this facilitation and this inactivation seem to be calcium-driven phenomenon. So the kind of experiments then that we used to establish that calmodulin was the sensor for both facilitation and inactivation and how it manages to orchestrate both are illustrated in this slide. So now we're switching to a little bit more biophysical format. And we're looking at the currents that are evoked not by action potential waveforms, but by rectangular pulses. So if you give a short test pulse just by itself here, the kind of calcium current you get through these same channels is a little bit peculiar. You get a very rapid upstroke, like a self-respecting voltage-gated channel would give you. But then you have this slowly increasing component there. And that's as if the calcium coming in during the pulse is producing positive feedback on the channel, making it want to open more. So we call this the facilitation. You can do a variation of this experiment now. If you pre-charge the channel with a little prepulse and there's calcium entry beforehand, so then the channel already has a chance to become better, to become pre-facilitated. And in line with this expectation, the channel will just activate quickly right up to the facilitated level. So what you can do is sort of integrate this area, this green area, and work it into a manner of index for the amount of positive feedback produced by calcium that came in during the prepulse. So if you plot that, the amount of facilitation versus the prepulse voltage, you get this nice bell-shaped curve here. Okay, and the fact that it's bell-shaped for the cognoscenti in the audience is beginning to argue that it's a real calcium-driven rather than voltage-driven sort of process. Now, to be exactly accurate, you need to repeat this experiment in barium, and there's another phenomenon, less prominent, that gives you this monotonic facilitation. That's a voltage-dependent form of facilitation. So the calcium-driven part of the positive feedback is this difference between them, this G value, which has a value of 0.2. So if you just hold that value in your mind. Okay, so that's over tens of milliseconds. Now, what happens if we just pulse the same channel for 2 seconds, okay, over here? So all of this facilitation is scrunched up into the beginning here. You can't really see it. On the longer time scale, what you see is that if you run calcium through these channels, the current decays faster than if barium goes through them. And this extra decay of calcium is due to the negative feedback regulation by calcium on the channel, a calcium-driven inactivation of the channel. And the magnitude of that, you can imagine, is related to this difference, this red-shaded area. And you can work this into a metric in the average data for the strength of the negative feedback, an F value of about 0.3. Okay, so that's just a way of quantifying the positive feedback facilitation and the negative feedback. Now, what begin to argue that calmodulin is the sensor for both of these, we just did the following experiment. We take the same PQ-type channels but co-transfect it with the gene for calmodulin, but a mutant gene for calmodulin, where each of the four EF hands has a point mutation that reduces the calcium binding tremendously. So we call this CAM1234 because each of the four sites has a knocked out calcium binding, if you will. And lo and behold, you get a very pleasing result. There's no prepulse dependence, and the G value goes to zero. So the positive feedback is almost eliminated. And the negative feedback, the calcium and the barium, are almost decaying at the same rate, and the metric in the population is almost zero. So we knocked out the negative feedback as well. Okay. So now, if you think about it a little bit more, that's nice, but how does calmodulin, which in sort of the first order view is all or none, how does it manage to produce two forms of regulation? So we did the following kind of experiments, which have proved to be very, very useful over the years. Now we co-transfect the channel not with a calmodulin that's fully mutagenized for calcium binding, but only lacking calcium binding, say, in the end lobe, preserving calcium binding to the C-terminal lobe of calmodulin. And what you see is that the facilitation is still there. We have this green shaded area, and the G value is about 0.2, just like it was in control. But at the same time with this mutant, the calcium and barium are decaying at the same rate, the F value for the negative feedback is gone. So that suggests that something to do with calcium binding to the end lobe was important for the negative feedback, but the positive feedback could get along pretty well with calcium binding to the C-terminal lobe. And if you do the flip experiment, now calcium can only bind to the N-terminal lobe, you get rid of most of the facilitation, but you leave the inactivation pretty much intact. So that's a really nice experiment. At least we thought it was a really, really nice experiment. And here's just a summary if I went a little bit too fast. So normally a channel with endogenous calmodulin, or if you overexpress it, you're going to have this size of positive feedback facilitation and this size of negative feedback inactivation, calcium inactivation. If you co-transfect the channels with a calmodulin that doesn't bind calcium at all, then you knock out both forms of regulation. If calcium is only allowed binding to the C-terminal lobe, you only have facilitation. If calcium is only allowed to the N-terminal lobe, you mainly have this inactivation component. So from these kind of experiments, you can draw a different kind of model where calmodulin has some very, very interesting features. The first of these is, wow, we co-expressed a calcium-insensitive calmodulin, and we got an effect. Now, if you thought about this experiment too much at the beginning, it doesn't make any sense. We overexpressed a bad calmodulin. We didn't do anything to the amount of good endogenous calmodulin. So if this was working according to the first order view, calcium comes in through the P-type channel. Our bad calmodulin does nothing, and the good endogenous calmodulin should go ahead and regulate the channel. In fact, early on in the lab with postdocs, we were debating, you know, this, you know, whether this was a worth experiment worth doing or whether we should move on to do anything. And we took a kind of philosophical approach that I think Chris Miller espoused. It comes from the Nike commercial that you can't psychoanalyze things too much. Just do it. So in the fact that we did it, we found something interesting. And what it suggests, having a bad calmodulin that actually knocks it out, is that the bad calmodulin is a mimic of apocalmodulin. Apocalmodulin is already pre-associated with the channel on some sort of very, revered parking spot on the channel. And so the bad calmodulin, being overexpressed, will sit there, hog that site, but then when calcium comes in, fail to undergo the subsequent conformational changes to drive the regulation. We also have done some FRET experiments on holo channels to confirm that apocalmodulin is in fact pre-associated with the channel, but the logic for it already comes from the dominant negative action of these calmodulins. The second thing that's different than the first order view is it can't be all or none. We've done subsequent experiments to convince ourselves that pretty much there's one regulatory cam per voltage-gated calcium channel. So how do you explain the two forms of regulation with the two different kinds of mutants? It must be that calcium binding to the C-terminal lobe can trigger one set of conformational changes, okay, leading to facilitation, and that calcium binding to the N-terminal lobe can trigger a different set, leading to inactivation of the P-type channel. So calmodulin is a lot smarter. It can be on the target it's regulating, and calcium signaling through one lobe can sort of semi-autonomously trigger one kind of regulation. Calcium binding to the other lobe can trigger another kind. So that's kind of like, you know, when you buy a laptop computer, you always have too few USB ports, so that makes business. You have to go to the store and buy a USB splitter and get a couple things. So calmodulin is taking the one signaling and giving you two. But we dreamed a little bit further. We wondered whether, rather than just splitting the signal into two, that it might actually be stripping off different types of information that are encoded in the calcium fluctuations near the channel. Okay, so the analogy that I like to use is very common, like an FM stereo. I was listening to NPR coming in this morning, driving from Baltimore. And if you listen very carefully, what comes out of the right speaker is a little different than what comes out of the left speaker. Even though there's one radio carrier wave, there's two streams of information that are encoded in there. So in your fondest dreams, maybe the lobes of calmodulin are not just splitting the signal, they're actually stripping out different pieces of information within this several tens of nanometer, or the nanodomain of the channel. That would be really interesting. But how could you come up with an experiment to actually test that? Actually, it was very easy. It was very, very easy. It came about from some control experiments that turned out in a bizarre way, but in a nice way for us. So here I'm just replaying the data that I've shown you. This is the standard way that we measure facilitation in the P-type channel. We do this usually under what we call pseudo-physiological calcium buffering, 0.5 millimolar EGTA, which would allow the global aspect of calcium concentration to rise when many of these channels turn on. This is a global signal. And under this condition, you get this pre-pulse dependence of these short test pulses, giving you a measure of the facilitation with our standard value of 0.21. So you've seen that data. As a control experiment, what we thought we would do is now we'll fill the cell with 10 millimolar BAPTA, high affinity, rapid on rate calcium chelator. We should eliminate calcium almost everywhere. The global calcium would be gone. The only place the calcium would be left, if you do the diffusion modeling, is right in the nanodomain of the channel. So when we did that, we still had the facilitation, and the G value was 0.24, just about the same as it was in the control. So it must be that calmodulin is within this nanodomain, beyond the reach of BAPTA in terms of chelating calcium. That was nice, but, you know, a little bit surprising, but since calmodulin is pre-associated, not really countercultural. Okay, now let's do the same experiment now looking at inactivation. So here's the same data I showed you before. We're doing under pseudo-physiological calcium buffering, 0.5 millimolar EGTA, where we are allowing a globalized rise of calcium. The F value is 0.3 or so. It's just what I showed you before. Now, the same experiment, 10 millimolar BAPTA. My guess is that, well, since there's one calmodulin and the lobes of calmodulin can't be that far apart in terms of diffusion space constants, that the inactivation should also be preserved. But very surprisingly, it was almost completely eliminated. The F value is essentially zero here. So in this case, we lost the global signal. We only have the local signal. The N-terminal lobe is not responding at all. That's both peculiar and potentially very wonderful and interesting. So let me sort of try to think through what we were thinking at the time. So here's a kind of Gedanken slide. Here's a single P-type channel stochastically gating. When it goes downward, the channel's open. There's about a picoamp of calcium coming in. When the channel stochastically closes, it comes upwards, and the calcium vanishes away. If we were able to measure the calcium within the nanodomain, the calcium concentration, we would imagine the signal to be something like this. So every time the channel opens, if you do the diffusion modeling, not us, but Erwin Nayer and Michael Stern, many people have contributed to this theoretical sort of consensus. When the channel opens, the calcium will rise to very high levels, maybe 100 micromolar or more. When the channel closes stochastically, most of that decays away within microseconds. Okay, so there are these spikes that are tightly synchronized and caused by the stochastic opening of the channel to which calmodulin is pre-associated. There's also another signal. It's a little bit overdrawn here in this cartoon, but there'll be a slowly changing pedestal, maybe in the 1 to 10 micromolar range. And that signal is the global signal. That's the aggregate calcium that arises from all the other calcium sources in the cell. So you get this global pedestal and these local spikes. Now, we did an experiment where we changed the signal from this in physiological buffering to this in high buffering, say with BAPTA. Okay. And for the C lobe of CAM, which was triggering the facilitation, it responded the same whether we use physiological buffering or whether we use BAPTA. So that C lobe must be responding to this signal pretty much the way as it's responding to this signal. So from that, you would deduce that the C lobe must be bred to see the spikes. It's a locally selective calcium sensor. The C lobe is doing what you would expect for a resident calcium sensor. You have this wonderful parking spot. You use it. You listen to the channel that you're attached to. That's not surprising. But now if you do the same kind of logic, the N lobe responds to this signal but not to this one, it seems like it's responding to this tiny 5 micromolar signal. Its virtue is that it's long-lasting. It's not intermittent and fickle, but it's really small. So it's kind of hard to imagine. It's wonderful in a way if it's true, because if you have a resident calcium sensor, you don't always want to have a mode of feedback where you only listen to yourself. You want to be able to orchestrate feedback over a wider spatial expanse. Otherwise, you'd have, you know, dyssynchrony in a cell. Maybe our country, in a way, you know, if you think about it in that thing, should don't want to just pay attention to yourself, need to be more sensitive to the needs of other countries. Well, the N-terminal lobe of CAM seems to have that capability. Okay, but it seems kind of weird. Could it really be true? Because this is really small. I mean, we're talking about a 10, 20-fold difference in amplitudes, and that's pretty hard to come up with a model that can do that. But it's really, really true. We've done it many, many ways. The latest way that we've done it, Dipayan Chaudhuri, a MD-PhD who recently graduated from my lab, published this paper in the Journal of General Physiology in 2007, where we looked at single PQ-type calcium channels with calcium as a charge carrier. Now, when you do an experiment like that, it's very, very nice. By definition, if you have one channel, you only have a local signal. There's no global signal, by definition. So if this selectivity is true, you should only have the C-lobe-driven process, only facilitation, and not inactivation. That's exactly what we see. So no prepulse, prepulse. Here's the single-channel data. You average it, ensemble average. You get that slow phase. Here's the facilitation. You prepulse it. It goes right up to that. Interestingly, for the whole cell record, you should have that much calcium inactivation. Here you don't see any. So on that basis, it seems really, really true. So what we have in calmodulin in terms of regulating P-type channels is the equivalent of a very important social skill of human beings, say, at a cocktail party. So we've all been at a cocktail party. There are many different people at the party, many different conversations. And suppose you're this person here, and you're interested in this person. Well, that's sort of proximity. And so you can exert a kind of local selectivity. You can ignore all the background chatter and focus in on this conversation. So that's really great. But many of us have the experience that after a few moments you realize that, well, this person is not as interesting as I thought at first blush. I want to get out of this. But while still looking like you're close, still being close, looking like you're listening, you can ignore that person actually while still smiling and exert a global kind of selectivity and listen to someone else. Oh, that might be a more interesting person to talk to. That's global selectivity. That's very important because then after making your polite exit, you can go over to a more meaningful sort of conversation. Cal Modulin is doing that in a way at the cellular and molecular level. Now that would be enough to get funded because, okay, P-type channels, it's the main calcium entry pathway in the central nervous system. But Haoya Liang in my lab was able to synthesize a lot of work that was coming from other labs and take us out of sort of a more myopic view of calmodulin regulation of the channels and turn it into a panoramic view. So most of the action as of 2003 was focused on the P-type channel, which had the facilitation inactivation, and on one of the L-type channels, one that's dominant in the heart, CAV1.2, where it seemed to have a C-lobe-driven form of inactivation. What Haoya realized is that all the other members of the CAV1.2 class, in fact, showed some sort of calmodulin regulation. Okay, and sometimes the regulation was triggered by the N-terminal lobe of calmodulin, calcium binding to the N-terminal lobe. Sometimes it was triggered by calcium binding to the C-terminal lobe. Sometimes it was facilitating, sometimes it was inactivating. But what seemed to be the case here, what was known are these colors at the time, is that when the C-lobe was responsible, its signaling was calcium buffer insensitive. It was bred for local calcium selectivity. The N-lobe, for the three that we knew about at that time, good thing we have two of these, at the time, they were all buffer sensitive, so they seemed bred for this global selectivity. So when you see this kind of pattern, very clean pattern, in biology, you sense that there's something wonderful afoot. And so for the past several years in my lab, from that time, since Haoya was able to synthesize this, we've been trying to work out the biological consequences of this design rule and also the mechanisms. Okay. So that gives you a taste. I think you're convinced that although calmodulin, Claude Clay did some seminal work, has continued through the years, but it's still got a lot of wonderful tricks. We're still finding them out, 2003 to 2008. How does it do it? How does local selectivity come about? That's something that at every seminar that I gave, people said, that's really great. It looks like you've got data that shows that these phenomena exist, but how could it ever be? And how do you even think about approaching this? I mean, even if you had a crystal structure of the calcium channel, which we would love to have, it wouldn't tell you how this decoding comes about. So the first part of it is we got lucky. We got a clue. Ivy Dick, a graduate student in my lab, ably supported by Mike Tadros, found that there is this module that you can clone into the channels that will switch the selectivity of the N-lobe calmodulin signaling between local and global signaling. We call this N-scape for reasons that will be apparent in just a moment. And this was just recently published, but I'm going to take you through because it's a little bit dense. That's what my colleagues say. So let me try to unwrap this for you. So let me just review the problem, okay? The problem of local and global calcium selectivity. So under physiological calcium buffering, when a channel opens stochastically, the calcium signal has these enormous calcium spikes and a small pedestal that's the global signal. You can break up the signal into local spikes and a global pedestal. And their amplitudes are enormously different. Notice the axis break here. I've had to do that so that you can see something at the bottom. Now, for the C-lobe, which of calmodulin, which has a local selectivity, if it produces calcium inactivation, which I'll call CDI from this point, okay, the current inactivates. For C-lobe, you get inactivation under physiological buffering, but you get pretty much the same inactivation under high buffering. That we call local calcium selectivity. Now, what's global selectivity? The representative of that is a process that's triggered by the N-lobe. So under physiological buffering, if it triggers inactivation, you get nice inactivation triggered by calcium binding to the N-lobe. Okay? But if you add buffering, take away this global signal, so you only have the spikes, you get very, very little regulation. That's what we call global calcium selectivity. How does that come about with these very, very different amounts? Okay. Well, here's a channel that, another one that we've been studying for a long time, the N-type channel, CAV2.2, very important in pain transmission. And this is a great prototype representative of global signaling by the end lobe of CAM. The end lobe of CAM in this one, under physiological buffering, will produce this faster decay of calcium than barium currents. So you get this calcium inactivation driven by calcium binding to the N-terminal lobe of CAM. All right. If you repeat the experiment in high millimolar BAPTA, getting rid of the global signal, most of the regulation is gone. So this has a global preference for selective. This is nothing new. This is just an example of that. Now, we've made a lot of mutations, a lot of chimeras, many manipulations of all of these different channels looking for structural determinants of these sorts of things. What we found is that sometimes we can weaken the calcium inactivation, but we are never able to change its essential calcium selectivity, whether it's local or global. That seemed to be somehow inherently, inextricably wound into the, you know, the fabric of the channel. You couldn't, like, strip out some part that you could get your hand on until we had this channel. So this channel is a kind of a strange chimeric channel. Most of the action in the field, a lot of labs finding all kinds of interesting things, calmodulin binding on the C-terminal lobe of these channels. But we made a chimeric channel where the amino terminus was replaced. Now we put in the amino terminus from the cardiac L-type channel, CAV1.2 on there. And when you did this experiment in 10 millimolar BAPTA, lo and behold, you have strong calcium inactivation. It's as if we change the selectivity of the calcium inactivation driven by calcium binding to the N-terminal lobe from global to local. So when we saw this, we recognized that there was something good in this, because before this, there were a universe of possibilities as to the mechanism. Now, although we didn't know what it was doing, something of the answer lay within these 139 amino acids. 139 amino acids is a lot nicer to think about than a universe of possibilities. So, what did we do? We did the obvious thing. We said, well, we don't know what's in there, but let's chop away at it. Maybe the secret is not within just 139 amino acids. Maybe it's in something smaller. So we whittled away. We chopped off fully 81 amino acids, and this red trace, calcium inactivation in 10 millimolar BAPTA, a proxy for local selectivity, was just the same as the full length. But one more amino acid taken away, the tryptophan at position 82, and you can see that some of this negative feedback is going away. And you chop away more, you get increasing weakening. So now if I do the plot for you, here's the amount of calcium inactivation in 10 millimolar BAPTA. You can think of it as how local the selectivity is, plotted against number of amino acids that we chop away from the amino terminus here. So it stays pretty much at its happy level up here until you hit this little bump here and you have this little residuum here. But something good is in this region. That in itself was very, very happy. I mean, for those of you who are young PIs, you try to convince your graduate students and postdocs to do an experiment, you know, you always hope that you would see something like that, but you always fear that there would be some global holistic thing in there. But in this case, there seemed to be something good. Still, when we looked at the sequence, we didn't see anything obvious as to what it could be. But Lai Hak Tay, another graduate student in my lab, has been using these live cell FRET2 hybrid assays. And basically, it's an interaction assay that you can perform in live cells. So it's in the arguably one of the more relevant milieus for an interaction assay because you're doing it in the cytoplasm. So the basic idea is very, very simple. You have CFP and YFP, two color mutants of GFP. If you fuse them to two black molecules that don't interact, then you get the following kind of situation. You shine short blue light. You mainly excite CFP. You get mainly cyan fluorescence. The short blue light very poorly excites the yellow fluorescent protein. But if you fuse them to a black ball and a gray ball that actually interact in the cell, and you pull these fluorophores within 100 angstroms, their sweet spot halfway is about 50 angstroms, now something very nice happens. You shine the same short blue light, but by resonance energy, without giving off a photon, you excite the yellow fluorescent protein, and you give off yellow fluorescence. So if you quantify how yellow a preparation is versus how cyan it is in terms of fluorescence, you might have a way of reporting interactions in cells. So We've been using this in a semi-quantitative way. And Lihok reasoned that, okay, there's something special about the L-type channel amino terminus that is not present in the N-type channel amino terminus. It must be interacting with some special molecule or interacting with some loop of the channel. There must be something special about it. So he looked for many kinds of interactions. And in the end, this is the one that mattered. So he found that in the amino terminus of the L-type channel, this gray bar here, he could have FRET interactions with calcium calmodulin. So we have YFP on the calmodulin, CFP on the amino terminus of the L-type channel. In the absence of calcium, you just have a FRET ratio of 1. This FRET ratio is our index of FRET efficiency. It's directly proportional to the FRET efficiency, and 1 is the absence of FRET interaction. So for the APOCalm form of calmodulin, there's no interaction. But when you elevate calcium, you get this nice elevation. If you look at it for the N-type channel amino terminus, there's no interaction, either in the absence of calcium or in the presence. And there's another nice thing that you can do with this. Different cells have different amounts of YFP tag CAM and potential binding partner. So what you find is you have different amounts of FRET related potentially to the fractional binding. So we use a measure of FRET that is YFP-centric. So FRET will go up as the fraction of these which are bound to a potential binding partner goes up. So if you work the data from many cells, you can make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. You can get a binding curve out of that. And what that tells you not only is that not just no interaction or interaction, you can tell the relative dissociation constant, how tightly it's bound. So that's pretty nice to have in a live cell. So Lihok had found this special property for the amino terminus of the L-type channel. So what we did then is find which third of it had the calcium calmodulin binding site. So it wasn't the most amino terminal part, it wasn't the most carboxy terminal part, it was the middle section, which no calmodulin binding algorithm would identify as having a potential calmodulin site. But there it was. And then we played the assay kind of like a Stradivarius, cutting it from the left, cutting it from the right, and if you didn't invade a critical inner region, you had very nice binding. But as soon as you invaded a critical region, you lost your FRET almost, and your estimated KDs were very, very high. So when you plot the relative dissociation constant, a measure of calcium CAM binding to the amino terminus, versus the number of amino acids truncated away from the amino terminal end, so this measure of calcium CAM binding, and compared it to the functional data, you say that there's a transition that lines up very well in this yellow region. And we extracted this part as a peptide in vitro and showed spectrofluorimetrically that there's very nice binding in calcium CAM, but not to APOCAM. And if you mutate tryptophan at position 82, where you get this drop here, most of that goes away. So on that basis, we concluded that this calcium CAM binding site has the ability to transform spatial calcium selectivity of the end lobe. So we called it N-terminal spatial calcium transforming element, or N-scape. Okay. In our lab, we actually called it another name, which is the Rosetta Stone. And so if you remember from your archaeology, for a while, we had no way to translate Egyptian hieroglyphics until they had this stone, which had the same information encoded in ancient Greek, which was known, and Egyptian hieroglyphics. So this N-scape, in our mind, was a manner of Rosetta Stone. Okay. We were very excited about it, but when we went to the national meetings, some of our more sober colleagues, you know, pulled me aside and said, well, David, this is very nice. This site, N-scape, does indeed seem to transform the spatial calcium selectivity of your chimeric channels, but does it have anything to do with the way that naturally occurring channels would produce local or global selectivity? Fair enough. And so motivated by questions like that, we looked a little bit at where this N-scape was. It was not only present in the cardiac L-type channel, CAV1.2, but very interestingly, was also present in CAV1.3, or the alpha-1D subunit. This is a very dominant kind of voltage-gated channel in the cochlea. I don't know if any of you are from the hearing science sort of camp, so you'd be really happy that this N-scape is really there. It's not present in the CAV2 channels. So this presence of the motif, at least, in CAV 1.3 or the Alpha-1D channel immediately drew our interest because Phil Yang, another graduate student in my lab, just in 2006, had been able to show that the CAV 1.3 channel, the main sub-unit is Alpha-1D, had a strong calcium inactivation, which was fully mediated by calmodulin, pre-associated with the channel. But the important thing is that the N-lobe component of the inactivation, here you can isolate it by co-transfecting a calmodulin where calcium bonding only goes to the N-terminal lobe, okay, the N-lobe component is very strong and robust, as well as a fast component. Here's the C-lobe component. So this has two forms of calcium inactivation, a C-lobe component, fast kinetics, and a slow form, which is driven by the N-terminal lobe. And it's very, very strong. But when we identified this, we did this in physiological buffering. Well, this channel has an N-skate site. So if the notion that this works in natural channels is true, this kind of calcium inactivation, even though it's triggered by calcium binding to the N-lobe, should have a local selectivity. It should survive, even though we chelate calcium with 10 millimolar BAPTA. So we did the experiment. And here it is in 10 millimolar BAPTA. Clearly, it has very strong calcium inactivation. Okay. When we mutate the critical tryptophan in CAV 1.3, it's position 44, to an alanine, this locally signaled calcium inactivation goes away. And just to be sure that it wasn't that calcium inactivation became derelict altogether, when we went to physiological buffering, the calcium inactivation came back. Okay. We also did this with careful inspection, now sensitized to this possibility, looking for an N-lobe component of CDI and CAV 1.2 channels. We found it, and it behaved in just this way. So to answer my colleague, this N-skate site was not only of importance to chimeric channels. It was actually the way that nature customizes spatial selectivity of the N-lobe-triggered regulation of CAV 1.2 and 1.3 channels, making these local, whereas for global signaling in the CAV 2 class, they're global because they lack an N-skate site. So just to fill in the table for completeness, I showed you this a little earlier. There's some question marks here. These columns here are driven by N-terminal lobe calmodulin calcium inactivation, some form of it. They turn out to be BAPTA insensitive. They're locally selective. The reason for that is they have an N-skate. But lacking the N-skate, we have N-terminal lobe signaling that is global. So we're enriching that paradigm. So we had this clue. We had this occult calcium cam binding site that somehow very nicely could switch selectivity. We still haven't decoded the mechanism, but we're a lot closer. And so this is where Michael Tadros has taken the lead, and we recently published this. It's a little bit dense as well, some of my colleagues say, so let me try to unwrap the secret that was encoded in N-skate. Okay, so here's kind of the problem in a more realistic view, actually. So we've modeled calmodulin as this blob, 50 nanometers from this single calcium channel. When the channel's open, it lets in these calcium ions. And there's buffer in here that could be eating it up as well. Sometimes when it turns red, a calcium ion collides with calmodulin. It has the choice of binding or not. This is what it looks like played in sort of fast motion when the channel's on. This is what it's like when the channel's off. Somehow the N-lobe likes this that little drizzle in between. Okay, this frenetic activity during this isn't enough. Let me render it another way. So here is like an open period of a channel under simulation. We're simulating this in a particle simulation. Here's where the channel closes. This is the global average signal. This is the high calcium when the channel's open. If you plot it out kind of like single channel recordings, each upward tick is a collision of calcium with the calmodulin. So when the channel's open, it's like a machine gun burst. It gets hit a lot. When the channel goes off, you have this couple micromolar sprinkling there. Now, the N-lobe responds to this kind of activity. It doesn't respond to this kind of activity. All this frenetic activity, mostly preserved, is not enough. Somehow it cares about this little drizzle in between. How can you possibly do that? That's the problem. And N-skate somehow switching it. So in order to do this, what I'd like to introduce to you, we needed one theoretical advance, and we needed three experimental advances. And at the end of that, I hope there's time, we can do the experiment that I think confirms this or is strongly supporting a certain kind of mechanism. So the first theoretical advance is model everything you know, simply, not too complicated. So, you know, it's been known that calcium binding to a lobe of calmodulin triggers a form of regulation of the channel. So we model this in the first order, as many calmodulin people do, to the first order. Just take it one lobe at a time. They're semi-autonomous. And so if you imagine this lobe of calmodulin, this end lobe of calmodulin in the alcove, molecular alcove of the channel, it's briefly taken a break from being pre-associated with the channel. And if calcium's around, it can bind calcium, okay, according to this chemical reaction. And if it stays around like that long enough, it can bind to the channel at an effector site and produce regulation, let's say calcium inactivation. That much people had modeled. But what hadn't really been taken into account is, wait, there's another site here. A lot of time, the calcium-free lobe of calmodulin is bound to the pre-association site. And like many things, if you look at it for the pre-association site, this won't bind calcium very well. All right. So Mike Tadros said, okay, well, let's also plug in some of the kinetics that you would see for the N-terminal lobe of CAM. So the nice thing about the N-terminal lobe of CAM is that not only is the on rate for calcium binding pretty fast, the off rate is pretty fast. So more or less, if you have millisecond gating, you're going to flicker between states 2 and 3 pretty much as the channel opens and closes. The channel recovers from inactivation pretty slowly, over hundreds of milliseconds. So this transition is going to be kinetically slow. And then we weren't sure exactly how that would be, but let's just imagine that's slow as well. So if you do that and do a numerical simulation on a computer, we were happy about this because it was sort of 2 months of models that couldn't do anything. We got this result, which is really nice. So this is all in silico. You give spikes with a pedestal, and this model inactivates very nicely. You remove that pedestal. See the axis break? We still have pretty big spikes. In this case, we kept them just almost the same size. And most of the inactivation is gone. So it was like, wow, Mike, how does it do that? That's incredible. And you have to ask that question, because when you get into a numerical model, this is pretty simple, but clearly a lot of times in silico, the thing that you're modeling is as complex almost as part of the nature you're trying to understand. You may not understand how it does it. So how is this set of rate constants able to do it? So intuitively, I can offer this explanation. First, you have this state here where when calmodulin is calcium-free, it's bound to a pre-association site. It can't bind calcium directly, or at least not very well. Okay? So while you're here, you're protected from inactivating, going to state 4 by these high calcium pulses. So if you can hide out here while these pulses are going on, you're protected from inactivation. Okay, that's one feature. But should you escape, so you're out here, and calcium is high during an opening of a channel, you'll quickly go to the calcium-bound form. But here's the saving grace. For the end lobe, when the channel closes, you'll quickly go back to here. So while you're here, even though you've unbound from state 1, you can't inactivate. So in a lot of things in biology, when you have two factors that are protecting you against something, you get some nonlinear synergistic interaction. And it's in that, the essence of it, that this numerical model can resist going to inactivation despite the fact that you have this train of very enormous high-amplitude pulses. Okay. So that's in words, but that's not really precise. Okay. Now what I want to offer you is true understanding. Going back to my professor Sagawa, we used to have these conversations about what it meant to understand something. When is it that you understand the phenomenon that you're trying to understand in biology? You can get different things. You can get different correlations. He says you understand it in your gut. To me, you can understand something when you can represent it simply on a two-dimensional graph and use algebra to predict the equation. So I'm going to try to do that to explain how the local selectivity or global selectivity comes about. So first thing, we're going to think of running these thought experiments on a simple kind of input-output relation. The input is a calcium input. The output is the steady-state level of calcium inactivation. Okay, so more calcium, more inactivation. It'll have some weird shape. I haven't defined it. But we're going to think about this calcium input-output relation. Second thing, we're only going to do the experiment 10 millimolar BAPTA, because under that condition, calcium is only present when the channel is open and it reaches a defined fixed height of calcium spike, 100 some micromolar. Okay? So in that case, with this situation here, the average calcium is going to be proportional to the open probability of the channel. We might be able to control that. Okay. The output is calcium inactivation at steady state. We can measure that. So now, having this format, I can be a bit more precise. What do you mean by global and local? Now I'm going to define it in terms of little splotches on this graph. So if you're a global process, you don't have very much inactivation in high buffering. So for the physiological range of open probabilities for calcium channels, you're going to be way down here in the lowlands in this green global sort of plot here. So any performance plot that goes through this green zone is a model that has, or a mechanism that has, global selectivity. That's nice. As Chris Miller used to say, you start to understand something when you don't have to spill a lot of words over it. Now I just draw this green blob, and that means global. Local channels have the same open probabilities, but in high buffering, they have a lot of regulation. So you kind of have to go through this little red splotch up here in a performance characteristic to have local characteristics. So given that sort of framework, how is it that the SQS model that we went through on the previous slide actually produces global selectivity? So here's the SQS model. Quick kinetics, slow and slow. Now here's a very, very nice simplification of the kinetic model that you get a trick from Joel Henry Steinbach and Erwin Neher. It's sort of a, probably for many of you, long forgotten, the beautiful kinetic paper, biophysical, from the 1970s. And the bottom line of that is, if something moves quickly relative to other states, you can, to a very good degree of approximation, collapse those into one complex state. And even though there could be time-varying rate constants here, you don't really have to worry about that. All that had to be taken out, and so we replace any fluctuating calcium by these time-invariant rate constants here. Alpha times the open probability. And this one is A times 1 minus the open probability. So this complex time-varying model is reduced to a three-state model, and all the rate constants are fixed in time. Okay. So we all know we can solve this for the steady state occupancy in state 4 as a function of the open probability. I won't ask you to do that. I would ask my graduate students to do that, but I'm going to show you right here. This is a very simple algebraic equation which relates the steady state occupancy of being in state 4, essentially CDI at steady state, as a function of open probability. And this almost looks like a Michaelis-Menten equation, but not quite. So let's just linger on this for a second because it's well worth your purview. So what are the parameters? One of them is the parameter R. What is R? It's the ratio of how much the channel likes calcium cam divided by how much it likes apocam. How much it likes calcium cam divided by how much it likes apocam. The parameter R. Epsilon is how much the channel likes apocam modulin. So if R were greater than 1, this would pretty much give you a Michaelis-Menten-like equation. But let's suppose that the channel likes apocam more than it likes calcium cam, all right? That means R would be negative. That's something we're not used to looking at. You'd have a negative coefficient. If I plot that, lo and behold, you have global selectivity. Okay, so under that condition, this is how the SQS model produces global selectivity. But wait a second. Who says that R has to be less than 1? Maybe calcium cam can have a higher affinity for the channel than apocam. So if R is 1, you'd have this intermediate thing. If R is greater than 1, you have this local sort of thing. So the SQS model says, not only could I explain global selectivity, it should be possible, at least in principle, to have kind of smoothly adjustable calcium selectivity. If you're a modeler, you'll love this. You just say, oh, pleasing theory, nice conjectures. The problem, though, is if you're a realist, can you ever do experimental tests to test it? Okay, so now I'm going to give you some experimental advances. Number one, we needed a way where we could at will control the open probability, move along the x-axis of this input-output relationship. How can you do that without bad things happening, like changing unitary currents if you're at different voltages, different surface potential shifts? We wanted a way where we could just change, dial in the open probability. So we came up with this thing called voltage block. So imagine a channel. You jump to somewhere on the plateau of the activation curve. Here it is, merrily stochastically gating away. Here's the trick. Suppose we interrupt this with sojourns to the reversal potential, and we can control the dwell time at the reversal potential. Here, you'll jump up still on the plateau of the activation curve, so your gating won't change, but there's no driving force for calcium entry during these times which are colored. So from the standpoint of what calmodulin would see, it's as if your open probability is lower. So here's just an explicit example of this with a single-channel recording from CV1.3. No voltage block, 40%, looks like it has lower open probability, 80%. So we could dial it in. The only thing that we need, actually, is what's our starting open probability without any block. So we did it. We did a lot of very nice single-channel analysis to get the entire activation curve, and the peak here is 0.3. So in principle, we could go along the x-axis and do the experiments. But if you're a little bit critical, it's not very great. A lot of calcium channels have a very low open probability. You're not going to get very much of the x-axis to test your model. So we needed another experimental advance. So Mike Tadros did exhaustive mutagenesis of the CAV1.3 channel and looked for mutations that would increase the open probability but leave inactivation largely untouched. Long story short, he found a single point mutation in the S6 domain of the second homologous domain, S6 transmembrane segment of the second homologous domain. And here it is, this super channel, if you will. And here's a single channel analysis. For those of you who study calcium channel, it looks like we put on BK8644. We didn't. This is the way the channel gates. And here's its activation curve. More than doubled the open probability. We can voltage block that. So now we're in a kind of good shape. Now we need a third experimental advance. And the third experimental advance is N-skate itself. This is how. Okay, so remember the CAV2 channel, for example. It lacks the N-skate site. Okay? It's a calcium cam binding site, not an apocam binding site. So it would selectively, its absence, reduce this step, calcium cam binding to the channel. It's going to lower the parameter R, the ratio of calcium cam affinity divided by apocam affinity. Okay? In that case, with a low R, let's say it has one of these 1 over 10 curves, so it would be global. That's nice. You add in the N-skate. You put in a site that binds calcium cam, doesn't change apocam. It's going to boost this step here. It's going to boost R. And you'll go to one of these red curves, okay? So that's how you get local selectivity. But the most stringent test, what if we engineered this site to have varying degrees of calcium cam affinity? In principle, we should be able to morph these curves all the way between these at will, and we should be able to predict their shapes and their magnitudes. So that's the experiment we want to do. Theoretical advance, three experimental advances. So here's a full-blur test. CAV1.3, we've got a mutant cam on there so that we're only looking at N-lobe signaling. So here's a channel. It has N-skate. We can engineer it. We're going to see if this CDI versus PO theoretical relation is held true. We're going to mutate the N-skate site so that we change R in known ways. So here's the basic channel with 0% block, 40% block. And here's the plot, CDI, steady state, versus the open probability. We have an N-skate, so the R should be greater than 1. We have one of these convex down curves. So that's kind of nice. Now, what if we mutate the N-skate? We found an isoleucine that sort of, if you move it to alanine, sort of gets rid of a lot of the calcium cam affinity, not all of it. So now, essentially, you get voltage block on this. You get this green curve. So now the R value is as if it's less than 1. It's concave upwards, just like the theory. And then, what if we take the W to A, the most stringent, the most severe mutation, we get one of these very low R kind of curves. And then if we do an R to A, you get this sort of intermediate cyan thing. So what we could do is plot the R value obtained by fitting this theoretical equation to our electrophysiology data. And we can also measure biochemically by FRET2 hybrid the affinity of N-skate for calcium cam, 1 over KD. If the theory is right, the data should line on a straight curve. So it's pretty good. So we have some support for the SQS model. Well, how about one more thing? If my computer speed up, okay. So what about for CAV2 channels? Does this generalized from the CAV1. So here's the CAV2 channel, 2.2, the N-type channel. It lacks N-skate normally. We can do the single channel analysis. We can do the voltage block. It gives you a CDI PO curve. It's concave upwards, as if the R value is less than 1, because it lacks N-skate. We put in the N-skate site from that chimera I showed you earlier. We should boost the R value, right? We should get a curve that kind of goes like that. When you do the analysis, boom, you get that. And then if you mutate that to an intermediate affinity, you get this intermediate curve. And if you plot the R from electrophysiology versus the affinity estimated from fret 2 hybrid, you get a straight line. So not only does the SQS mechanism explain selectivity of the N lobe in CAV1 channels, but in CAV2. We think that explains the whole 1-2 family sort of thing. So let me close with this. I've gone a little bit long, but I didn't want to go so fast that the equation's glazed over. So I've spoken of three things which are illustrated by this cartoon here. So here's this calmodulin, here's this little channel, and here's this distant channel, and the yellow blobs are calcium ions here. The first part of the talk, I summarized basically 1999 to 2003 or 4, what the field has learned about how smart calmodulin is. Calmodulin, its lobes support local or global calcium feedback regulation of this channel. The C lobe is also always local. I didn't speak of that, but we could talk about that. The N lobe, initially all the channels we studied had global selectivity, okay, but it turns out that it's adjustable. In the second part of the talk, Ivy Dick, she found this clue. Although we didn't know how global selectivity came about, she found this N-skate site, or Rosetta Stone, that could switch the selectivity of N-lobe signaling from global to local. We didn't know the secret, but we had something that we could grab our hands onto. The third part, Mike Tadros, combined this finding of N-skate, combined it with theory and three experimental advances. We could validate an SQS model. The SQS model's here on the N-lobe. When the parameter R, the ratio of calcium cam affinity divided by apocam affinity, when the ratio R is less than 1, the binoculars of the N-lobe are looking away at the global signal. But when N-skate are present, or any time we increase the value of R, increase the ratio of calcium cam affinity to apocam affinity, according to the model, the focus of this binocular swivels in and looks local. Now, it explains the CAV1 and 2 channel. What we'd like to dream is that mechanisms like this, at least in principle, can explain some complex decoding of other calcium signaling molecules. And our lab is studying some of these other systems, calmodulin and other systems, besides voltage-gated calcium channels. So with that, I'd like to close. Let me make a few acknowledgments here. So in my lab, I have a wonderful technician, Wanjian Yang. She's my right-hand woman, and she's contributed in every aspect of this. Heather Agler, former graduate student in the lab, she actually made the CBBB chimera, the CBBB chimera. We're actually studying G-protein regulation of the channel, structure function of that. But like a good, really good graduate student, not only did it contribute to her project, she recognized and came over and said, Dave, isn't this changing this calcium inactivation that you other guys in the lab studying? She brought it to our attention. Takwa Sung, great Singapore collaborator. We're still collaborating. Really great molecular biologist, calcium channel biologist. We have a lot of ongoing collaborations. He contributed a lot to the discovery of CAM, C-lobe, N-lobe signaling in the PQ type channel. And what I didn't talk about in detail, but that nice little structure that we talked about, great colleagues at Hopkins. Dan Leahy is like a crystallographer par excellence. And his postdoc, Craig Vanderkoo, was even better than Dan. So with their help, some dumb ion channel electrophysiologists could get a little bit of structure and enjoy that. We're very grateful. Okay, so I'd like to close. Thank you for your attention. Take any questions you have.
So I have a question. How does any of this tell you anything about how the signal is actually transduced? So you're binding and not binding to N-skate, and that's talking to the channel. Do you have any idea of that? I mean, it's amazing that you can take a different channel and put the whole lens gate and get the transduction, right?
Yeah. Okay, let me repeat the question. So Joe asked, is there anything about the experiments that you did that can comment on how calcium cam binding events are transduced into, I guess, inactivation of the channel? And from what I've told you, you couldn't tell much, really. The calcium channel field, in a way, is still a little bit behind the potassium channel field. We don't necessarily know what the final transduced events are in terms of published data. But in terms of unpublished data, we have some very nice evidence that will be shown at the Biophysical Society meeting that, although we don't know the intermediate steps, what calcium cam regulation seems to be is an allosteric modulation of the S6 activation gates, the final concerted opening of the channel. So it's not a ball and chain. It's not a hinge lid. It's not a pore collapse. Those are features of voltage-gated processes. It's more of an allosteric modulation of these sort of peripheral gates. And it's kind of pleasing in a way because it falls in line with other kind of ligand-gated channels like maybe BK channels, those sorts of things, CNG channels. It's more in that camp. And you would expect that from calcium cam-driven sort of thing. So I think we have some traction on that part. As for the middle part, that's really hard. I think that's a hard question for the field in general, that we're still developing tools that would know how you bridge from the initiatory events to the final events. At least now maybe we know some of the final events, but we have to fill it in. And I think, you know, calcium channel people have a lot to learn from potassium channel work, some of the nice ligand-gated channels where it's a lot more structure and things like that.
That's an incredibly elegant set of experiments. When you showed us the local and global signal, sometimes you showed it on a linear scale of calcium concentration, and then later you showed it on a log scale. But in fact, the enrichment of the local signal over the global was maybe 20-fold and wouldn't look quite so big on a log scale. And that's not a criticism, but it made me think of what are the basal concentration of calcium, so the extent of the elevation of the local signal, and then to what extent, now that calmodulin is like any other molecule and not a special molecule that's all or nothing, to what extent you've got apocam in normal resting calcium.
Let me see. I'm not sure if I follow the second question. Let me do the first one. So I think the first question is really how large really is the local signal and what is the range of the global signal? So the global signals, I could kind of tell you we've done some measurements, and then physiologically I know global signals because, as Joe said early on, I was in the cardiac field and I did a lot of calcium measurements in muscle and things like that. So global signals can range from resting calcium, 100 nanomolar, and then if you really push a cell hard, you know, maybe 10 micromolar, somewhere in that range. Okay, the local signal, we don't really know how large it is. We can estimate it from modeling. That would be on the order of 100 micromolar. And in my lab, we've also tried to measure it. And the way we try to measure it, we take some genetically encoded calcium indicators and fuse them to the voltage-gated channels. So they're a near-field sensor. And then we pulse the channel and try to estimate the calcium from them. And so we would estimate something larger than 50 micromolar, could be 100 micromolar. So it's probably, the selectivity is probably an order of magnitude. Now, what was your second question?
Well, it was how low was the resting calcium, and maybe the calmodulin was partly bound by calcium.
Okay. So it's true that the calmodulin could be partly bound at certain types of resting calcium. I think for biophysical purposes, most of our experiments were done under 10 millimolar BAPTA, so I don't think there's much calcium bound. Physiologically, there could be a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. Question in the middle there.
Is the global selectivity in any way promoting cooperativity between
channels? Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the question is the global selectivity of forms of calcium CAM signaling promoting cooperativity among channels? I think it does. I think it does. I think there was evidence for this. We had some ancient experiments. This is going back. I mean, you always know your own experiments. At least I do. There was a Gordon conference where not everyone did. They showed data from different people and some eminent scientists in the lab, and some eminent scientists didn't recognize their own figures. But I remember them. And and we did some early experiments which were kind of bizarre. So we would look at, as Joe said, single calcium channels, and a single calcium channel, an L-type channel, can inactivate itself. But then we did experiments where there were two channels in the patch, and it looked like they inactivated faster than one channel in the patch. And I've received, from people that really know, I've received a little bit of grief about that, because they said, oh, in 1999, you showed that inactivation's by calcium binding to the C-terminal lobe of CAM, and you've also argued that's a local selective thing. So how did you and your dual patch, you know, get added calcium inactivation? So the answer, I think, and it's clear, we have more data on this now, there is a small N-lobe component of inactivation of these channels. And they are globally selective. And that global selectivity, I believe, is what made the calcium inactivation with two channels in the patch faster than with one channel patch. In fact, sometimes, you know, when you want a single channel, you get mega patches with tons of them. They inactivate a lot. So this global signaling does tie together. I don't know if it's cooperative, but it ties together multiple channels.
Thank you for the very nice seminar. The end state sequence is kind of interesting.
Yes.
It's very hydrophobic at one side on the carboxy and very hydrophilic on the other. And I'm wondering, you know, what kind of mutagenesis have you done on there for the aspartate, the arginine, or the lysine sequence?
Yeah. We basically done an alanine scan through it, and I don't know if I remember it off the top of my head. The tryptophan is the most important. There's an isoleucine. There's an arginine. The site is not particularly high affinity. It's 1 micromolar calcium CAM affinity. When you do a blast search or Psi blast search on it, you can't find it anywhere except in the certain CAV1.2 and CAV1.3 channels of higher order creatures. Like, I think, if I remember, I think zebrafish was the cutoff. Below that, you wouldn't find the motif. We did find hits of it, actually, very interestingly. We did find hits of it in bacterial proteins, TonD-dependent receptors.
Really?
Yeah. We actually sort of cloned that out to do FRET2 hybrid with it, and the bacterial sequence does bind calcium CAM, though I don't know that it does in bacteria. Bacteria do not have camodulin. I had a former postdoc who taught me stuff because he said, of course it doesn't, because that's why we can purify recombinant CAM from these bacteria. But bacteria do have CAM-like molecules that are endogenous, so it's quite possible that these CAM-like proteins could interact with motifs of this class in bacteria. We don't know that for a fact. And it raises some bizarre questions, like, you know, if you have this phylogenetic tree, how come you only have N-scate in TonB-dependent receptors and in higher order CAV1.2, 1.3 channels? There's this huge phylogenetic gap. I mean, it doesn't look like anything else. You find EF hands everywhere, and you find, you know, S4s everywhere. They came from bacteria all the way through. It wasn't like you had this one solution in bacteria, and then eons later, right, they showed up at just the right place in CAV1.2. So we don't know much about the motif other than that, though we had some nice fantasies about what it could. Maybe someone at the NIH can tell us it's more of a diverse, less sort of focus group than we have at Hopkins.
So why don't we thank David again, so we can all eat lunch.
That was great. It was fun to give.